All righty. Well, we're going to jump into the very last session, which is entitled Supernova and Supernova Remnants with Circumstellar Interactions. And we're going to start this session off with Raffaella Magudi, The Changing Look of Supernovae. Would you please pull the lights to come down? It's a 30-minute talk.
All right, so thank you for having me here. It's a very nice break after at the end of my double teaching quarter, and that's why I was able to join you only today, so I missed all the fun. So today I'm going to share with you some recent results in the world of what happens at the very end of the life of a massive star. And we do study transients for many reasons. Sometimes we just care about using them as tools, like in cosmology, or about what they do to their galaxies. And some other times we just care about what they produce, neutron stars and black holes, which are now a very hot topic for gravitational waves. But today, I'm going to concentrate on something different. So I'm going to concentrate on what we have learned recently about what massive stars do just before stellar death. I'm very fortunate to study these two big problems of what happens just before dying and what do we form with a team of young minds. And here I just want to highlight some of them, and you already had the chance to meet Giacomo earlier this week. So let's just concentrate on the first part of this problem. So what stars produce like which supernovae? So this is something that in my group we try to attack by using X-ray photons, all the way gamma ray photons, all the way to radio photons. We are photon inclusive, as the goal is to constrain the physics behind, and every piece of the spectrum is telling us a different piece of physics. So it's a great time to attack this question. It's a question that has been there forever, but it's a great time now to look back, effectively because of technological revolution, which is the fact that we are now in the position to look back at the very same patch of the sky one night after the other. And this is something that is happening in the optical, but is also happening in the radio, and hopefully the high-energy sky is going to catch up soon with a wide field instrument. So what have we been doing with these new things in town? So the first thing is that until a few years ago, we were used to find supernovae when they were bright, effectively because we were relying on amateur astronomers, who are fantastic, amazing people, but they tend to find things when they're bright. And right now, instead, we have the opportunity to just keep staring at the same patch of sky, just because we can have that information. And by doing that, we found quite a bunch of surprises. So first of all, we are now in the position to study supernovae when they are very, very young. And it turns out that monitoring this piece is extremely powerful, because that part encodes a lot of information about what the star was at the time of explosion. Another thing that we found out is that, differently from what my professors taught me during grad school, stars are not quiet before stellar death, which is kind of, it makes sense to me, but they have the experience, most of them experience a number of outbursts. So we are now in the position to characterize this type of pre-supernova outburst. So we now know that most of the stars are not quiet, are not sitting there quietly until stellar death, but they do experience, they do feel that the end is coming, and they produce outbursts. And as far as you can tell, on timescales, they go from a few days before stellar collapse all the way to years, like 30 to 100 years before death. Another thing that we have been able to do is to find new types of transients. And today I will not have the time to go through everything new that we found out, but if you're interested, please come and talk to me. And in particular, right now we are very excited about a new type of stellar explosions that reach a luminosity that are 10 times normal supernovae in a few days. So we call them the cows. So if you're interested, just come and talk to me later. The reason why we can do this is because we benefit from completely untargeted searches. So we give equal opportunities to each supernovae, the beautiful ones and the less beautiful ones, to produce and to give us the opportunity to discover a new transient. And that's why we were able to find these weirdos. The other piece of the answer is, why is that a good time to try and understand what master stars do at the end of their life? Is because we have now the opportunity to go back and learn by using multi-wavelength observations, literally using the entire spectrum. And this is the first step towards the multi-messenger astrophysics that is now reality in the gravitational wave world, and hopefully will become more of a routine also in the case of neutrinos. So let's get started here, and let's try to understand what happens there, and what happens in the last thousand years before death. We have different tools as observers to try to learn about what happens there. And today with you, we'll concentrate on three things that we have been doing. So first of all, we have direct observations. So we have telescopes, wide field telescopes that can cover the explosion region just in the years before. And so we can see this type of outburst. This is something where LSST, which is this guy here, will really shine. So LSST will produce a 10-year data set that is going to be incredible. It's going to be very deep, and we will have information about pre-supernova outbursts for a very, very large number of supernovae there. So among the supernovae that has been monitored so far, O9IP is still one of the best. So supernova 2009 IP, in spite of the name, was not a supernova in 2009, but it experienced a big eruption, or what we believe was a final explosion in 2012. But you can see that before doing that, in the years before, the same star was experiencing a number of very prominent outbursts. And here is the story of O9IP. Just to catch up, it produced an outburst in August 2009, and that's why we called it supernova 2009IP. The same star, however, experienced a number of other outbursts, and this is when the community realized that, well, supernova is a bad name, so let's call it supernova impostor. And then in 2012, we watched the same star going through a major display, a major explosion. And we think that might have been the end of it. So just to give you an idea of how things look like, if we zoom in to the 2012 explosions, you can clearly see that we have two phases. We have a precursor, and then we have the main event. And one thing that would stand out to any supernova observer is that this light curve here is full of wiggles, which is something that is, at least at that time, was not very common in supernovae. So the first thought was that our photometry was wrong. But now we know that it's pretty common. It's due to the fact that the shock is heating up stuff that was left in the environment by the outburst. To give you an idea of how much energy is there, it's not peanuts, it's quite a bunch of energy irradiated. This is just irradiated energy. So the supernova 09IP is, I would say, the best example right now, but it's not alone. So it has been shown that a number of other supernovae, and effectively more than 50% of the supernovae for which we were able to play this game, they do show evidence for pre-supernova outbursts. And here, I overlaid the light curve of 10MC without any scaling. This is exactly how they look like. And one thing that I'd like to bring you home is that these stars, they show outbursts on a typical, before the supernova explosion, on a typical timescale of 40 days before, which is telling us that probably the two things are connected, they are causally connected. And the fact that we have multiple stellar explosions that show this type of timescale is also telling us there is probably a deep, a really profound reason why these outbursts happen on this timescale. The other thing that I think is very important to try to understand what's the mechanism responsible for this outburst is that if we do a time temporal analysis of the outburst, what we find is that we find excess of power on, and that is significant on timescales between 20 and 40 days. So again, there is this timescale that is important for the star. So from an observational perspective, these are the two pieces of information that are that I consider very important that any physical model has to explain. So it turns out that for Supernova 09IP, we have been lucky. We have HST pre-explosion images, so we can see the progenitor star. And by doing rough numbers, we would infer a very massive star as a progenitor. So this was good and bad in the sense that people thought, well, you know, it's a very massive star, so maybe these kind of outbursts are there, but at the end of the day, those massive stars are just a little tiny fraction of all the stars, so we can just forget about them. And in the rest of the talk, I will try to convince you that it's actually not true, and that these outbursts happen across the spectrum of stars that produce core collapse. So the way we found out that it is actually true is by using two other methods. So one is flash spectroscopy, and then I will go into shell interaction. So flash spectroscopy is a beautiful tool. It consists in getting on the target as fast as you can after you have an explosion. What happens is that the first photons leaking out from the supernova illuminate the environment, they excite the medium, and the recombination of that medium produces features that will tell you about the composition of the outer layers of your of the star that just collapsed. So this is a tool that will tell us a lot of information about the very nearby environment. So it will tell us about what the star looked like very close to the time of explosion. The other tool that is very close to my heart is the shock interaction, it's all about the fact that we can use the supernova shock as a tool to probe the environment. So the shock is going to run into the medium, it's going to accelerate particles, and it's a very well-known source of X-rays and radio emission. And the idea is that by using the shock, we will be able to infer if in the medium we had some previous outbursts from the star that deposited some overdensities. The beauty of this method is that the shock velocity is much larger than the typical ejection velocities before death, which means that at any time t of our monitoring, we are actually sampling stuff that was ejected a fraction of time, that is V shock over V ejection, with this fraction being easily between 30 and 100 or even more. So the shock of a supernova effectively works as a time machine that tells us about the story of this star. So by playing this game, and we try to do it as well as we can, giving equal opportunities to every type of supernova, we were able to find some connections between the stellar structure at the time of collapse and what the star ejected before stellar death. So here you have a plot where I'm plotting the velocity of the fastest ejecta of a supernova versus the density probed by radio and X-ray observations. And here you have a supernova encoded by their level of stripping. So the most stripped progenitors are here, and the less stripped progenitors are here. And we are focusing here on supernovae that are hydrogen poor at the end. And what you can see is that there seems to be a trend between supernovae that are able to produce very fast ejecta and their density, which means that the density produced by their winds is actually much lower than what we find around supernovae, that we're able to retain some hydrogen at the end of explosion. So we are making a connection between how a star looked like and what the star at the time of collapse and what the star did just before dying. Another recent result has to do with type 2b supernovae, so those supernovae that were able to keep some little layer of hydrogen around. And what you have here on this axis is a measurement of the amount of energy radiated in the optical UV bands at the time during the cooling envelope emission, so the very, very early optical, that is telling you effectively how extended the progenitor was. And here, instead, you have an epoch of peak of radioluminosity, which is telling you is a proxy for how dense the environment is. And what we are finding is that more extended progenitors, they always tend to show evidence for a very rich environment. So effectively, just by knowing how extended the progenitor is at the time of collapse, we can say right away that the environment around that star is also very dense. So those are a few examples of results where we are finding a real connection between the projector structure that we see at the time of collapse and the mass loss of the star before stellar death. So while doing this exercise, we actually bumped into something very, very interesting, supernova 14C. And here you can see how much beautiful things look like if you have somebody that helps you out with images. And 14C is remarkable for many reasons, but one of the reasons is because we had, for the first time, an image and actually a time history of what the star looked like in the hard X-rays. The explosion looked like in the hard X-rays for the first time. And here you can see the NuSTAR image here. And I still remember when I called up Fiona Harrison, the PI of NuSTAR, saying, hey, we have a supernova and we think we have good chances to detect it with NuSTAR. And Fiona said, Raf, forget about it. NuSTAR is not done to observe this type of stuff. And then one of my I tend to be persistent, let's say that, and then Fiona repointed NuSTAR, and in 20 kiloseconds you can see how it looks like. After 5 years, I can tell you that this is still a bright target, and we are still observing it with NuSTAR. So let me go into the details about this supernova. So for anybody that does X-rays in supernovae, this looks like heaven in the sense that the first time we have a complete X-ray spectrum. Usually we deal with halves of the spectra, which means that we can't constrain the temperature with Chandra or XMM, which means effectively that we can constrain the shock velocity. Instead, with NuSTAR, we are in the position to constrain the shock velocities, the temperatures, and also the level of absorption, and to see how that changed with time. So let's go into the detail. So why 14C in a nutshell is so nice and important? Because we observed a supernova that made a complete transition between a type 1 at the beginning to a type 2, and in particular type 2N at the end, to the point that if I were just to show spectra in this phase and spectra in this other phase, but not telling you that's the same supernova, people might usually would say, well, this is a type 1, this is a type 2N. But we were actually able to see the entire evolution of it. So who is the 14C? It's a very nearby supernova, 16 megaparsecs. For whoever that does X-ray and radio follow-up a supernova, that means OK, you have good chances to see something. Beyond 30 megaparsecs, they tend to be faint for what we have so far. And here is how it looks like. I don't pay attention to the details here. The key message is that 14C sits in the middle of whole hydrogen strip supernovae, so nothing stands out. It's a very normal supernova. And if you take a spectrum where U means Denimino Savlevich in this case, here is how it looks like at early times. So it looks like a branch normal type 1. B means some helium is there. Nothing stands out. So the basic message is that at early times, this supernova did not look remarkable, was normal. However, Dan decided to keep monitoring this supernova, and here is what happened with time. So with time, we started building, witnessing the star, the supernova, building some broad H-alpha emission. This is something that doesn't happen usually for type 1 supernovae. They don't build broad emission, and the narrow one here has some contamination from the host. So we started thinking, wow, this supernova, something is happening with this supernova. And here you can see the whole evolution from a type 1b spectrum all the way to something that resembles way more a type 1c with type 2n supernova. Meanwhile, in the radio, here is what is happening. So if we put 14C into the entire world of radio supernovae, in this plot you literally have all the world of hydrogen strip supernovae, you can see that differently from most supernovae, type 14C has a very late time rise. And right now I can tell you that here I forgot to plot a piece, but we are right there and we start to go down. So if instead you are an X-ray astronomer and play the same game, so here is how 14C looked like. And if you thought that the world of radio supernovae was already a little poor compared to the 40,000 plus supernovae that we have in the optical, well, this is the world in the X-rays. So that's what we have for type 1 supernovae. So here is 14C, same thing. We start down here, and then we start going up, and we're still here on the plateau. So 14C is still a very bright target in the X-rays. So by now, I think you already understand what's going on. So we have a supernova that transitions from type 1 to type 2, building a lot of broad H-alpha emission. And while doing that, we have a rebrightening in the X-rays and radio. And this is due to the fact that our shock, instead of going through an environment that looks like this, a hydrogen-free environment, a beautiful wind-like environment, hydrogen-poor, instead of going through something like that, instead encountered a shell that is hydrogen-rich. The key and important thing here is that this shell of hydrogen-rich material is sitting very close to the explosion. It's just something 10 to 16 centimeters. So it has to do with something that happened in the very recent past of this star. And it does contain quite a lot of material. So now the key question that 14C, really stimulated is why. So why we have this hydrogen-rich shell sitting so close to an hydrogen-poor supernovae? And we thought about two possibilities. So one possibility is that this shell was ejected as a consequence of instabilities that developed inside the progenitor. And in this case, if that is the real answer, you understand that that is something that is very much connected to the fate of the star. So if this is the explanation, we should be able to observe this type of behavior in other supernovae and always timed with a particular phase of evolution of the star. The other possibility is instead that this star was helped in shredding the hydrogen envelope by a companion. And I'm sure that in this case you appreciate that the other star doesn't really know that the end of a companion is coming. So if this explanation is the right one, well, by observing more type 1C-like stuff, we should see a uniform distribution of the time of ejection of this envelope. The key thing that I'd like you to bring home is that based on one object only, 14C, both possibilities are actually there, and we can't rule them out. So. Now, in the spirit of trying to understand which of these two options is the correct one, we decided to go through the most homogeneous of the archives that we have, which is the radio one, and trying to see if other supernovae experienced a late-time rebrightening in the radio that is reminiscent of 14C. And it turns out that there are 40 supernovae, type 1bc supernovae, that have late-time observations that are late-time enough and deep enough to constrain something like that. And out of those, four show evidence for late-time rebrightenings. So the sample is in no way complete, homogeneous, or not. It is randomly acquired almost. But it's telling us that 14C is not alone, and that this type of fate of ejection of massive shells is probably more common than we think. It's just that we have not been doing very good monitoring. So what we are doing with my team is to play this game, but do it better. So we are trying to follow up at late times hydrogen-stripped supernovae and trying to see signs of these rebrightenings and signs of interactions with the idea to try then and understand if these ejections of the hydrogen shell is timed with something, is there a recurrent time scale or not. And try then to solve the mystery of, is it a consequence of binary interaction, or is something that is very much and deeply connected to the progenitor star instead. So what's happening right now with 14C? This is work by my undergrad, Daniel Breithauer at Northwestern. So you can see that we were able to trace down the evolution of the absorption of the hydrogen column density, and that the temperature of the emission was around 20 kV, and it plummeted down abruptly at some point. And our interpretation is that this is the time when the shock encountered the end, the other edge, the outer edge of the shell, and we are now cooling down. And we are now pairing with a group of theorists trying to, and actually Damiano is here, sitting here somewhere, yes, to try to understand better what physical properties is this related to in terms of masses, in terms of locations of the shell. So here is a sort of a summary slide of how we're trying to tackle this problem of trying to understand what stars do. So we use direct imaging, and with LSST again, we will be able to map what happens in the last 10 years of massive stars. So we have supernova, we do force photometry and go back and see what was there before. Earlier than that, we have to rely on the shock as a probe, but this is a very, very nice probe that helps us bridging the gap between these 10 years and thousands of years before stellar death. And using the flash spectroscopy, we are going to get information about the chemical composition of these outer layers of the star, which are going to tell us a lot about when the star collapsed. Okay, so if I were to plot into this discovery phase space of transient plot, what are the places where I think there will be a number of discoveries in the next few years? I think that this is one of those. So literally with one of the strengths of LSST is literally to go very, very deep. And here the time scales for the main survey of LSST are actually well matched to the pre-supernova outburst. So I would expect a lot of new information to come from the six filters observations of LSST. Okay, good. This is a standard plot that I show at supernova conferences, just to remark the fact that even if supernova explosions, they do put most of their energy in the optical, even if the X-rays and radio just carry less, way less than 1% of the energy, there is a lot that we can learn about the properties of the fastest ejecta of these explosions and learn about their environment. And this is another plot that here it's very easy to sell, but trust me, the supernova community is still very much focused on the optical only, and the message here is that we, even for young supernovae, it's very important to acquire a view of the entire spectrum, as we literally have different physics that peaks at different frequencies. So this gives us the opportunity then to really have understanding of the whole situation. So this is actually the end, and I think I have 30 seconds. Do I?
5 minutes,
okay. So I'm gonna I'll be here to take questions, and while I do that, I want to advertise a conference that I'm organizing in Evanston this summer that is related to how do we apply machine learning algorithms to find new transients. So thank you.
All right, very good. It's nice to have a contact to look at supernova with their CSM. You certainly learn a lot about the history of the mass loss. All right, questions? Knox, up here. Do we have the lights up?
So can you say more about, for the supernova remnant of imposters, what people think is physically going on?
Yeah, so I would say that there is no theory that I know of that can explain it all. And one of the theories that I'm more excited about is the one by Jim Fuller and Elliot Quadert and Chiodi. And their idea is that the outbursts that we are seeing are related to nuclear burning instabilities. And their way to solve the problem of how to make the core to talk to the envelope is by using waves. Yeah, sound waves, yeah. I think it's a beautiful mechanism. The problem there is that it would not be able to go back in time more than a few years before core collapse. So that's one of the problems. The other problem is that it doesn't have a recurrent time scale built in. So if we will be able to confirm really that we have these time scales of 20 to 40 days that are there in multiple and many explosions, then we will have to look for something else. Yeah.
All the way in the back.
Yeah. So I'm probably a bit biased here, but is there any prospect for using dust emission from the shocked, swept up CSM to investigate any of this, or is that more just something you find and then that's cool?
So dust emission. So if there is, so we do see every time, almost every time that we see something interacting like that, there is a bright infrared emission. If is that due to dust formation, I'm not sure because it's too hot.
Sorry, no, not quite dust formation, but more like if there's dust in the already in the CSM or something, then the kind of evolving infrared dust stuff. Could you use that to look at anything, or is it just too messed up and confused?
If I can use dust, I guess I don't understand the question.
I guess my question is that if the infrared emission is dust, then could you try and model that to, you know, combine with the optical and radio stuff to work out what was going on in the CSM, or is that just too many free parameters and whatnot?
Sure.
Over here.
Hi. Here.
Rafael.
I'm here. Okay. In this side.
Rafael, over here. To the right.
If it's a question related with the Supernova 2014C. You say that this object is at the beginning similar to a normal Taiwan
yeah.
B, but you show the comparison with a very peculiar Taiwan B is 2000D. So my question is,
well, OAD was peculiar because of the sharp breakout that was, well, some people think it was a sharp breakout found.
But the spectras have some peculiarities. So have you compared with other Taiwan
Dan?
B?
Yeah. Yeah. There was nothing. So I think a fair statement is that based on what we saw at early times, there is nothing that would have justified going so strong with every possible instrument across the spectrum to monitor the late time. It was the H alpha that popped up that triggered it all. Otherwise, we would have been very happy to classify that as a type 1B and. It would be sleeping soundly every night, yeah.
If I can just, I was asked to say it again. Classification in itself is not a clear-cut thing. We had to talk about that. But spectroscopically, using different methods of classification, it certainly fell within the 1B proximity, let's say that. Interesting, if you want to mention this, is that there was evidence in our spectral fit to have a high velocity H-alpha feature, so it seemed like there was some hydrogen in the atmosphere at the time of explosion. Some people don't believe that. I think it's actually endemic to a lot of 1Bs. It's just not very strong of a feature, but there is nothing grossly different in it from a 1B, and she's exactly right. In the standard plug and chug of supernovae, would not have stood out. In that sense.
Okay. Over, Andy?
I guess this is rare enough that there could be a triple system, like you could have the third star involved. Have you thought about that? Is there any evidence?
No, there is no evidence. But there is also no way for me to say that no, it's not the case. So, yeah. We can say that most likely the system has asymmetries with support maybe having a companion, but going from there to a triple, yeah.
Further questions? Yes.
Thank you very much, very nice talk. So my question is about the outburst before the supernova explosion. So naively, if you have an outburst, you're supposed to see a large amount of material ejected from the progenitor stars. In that case, you may see a brightening in the middle infrared, but you will see the target become fainter in the optical, naively, I think, probably in that case. So did you compare the infrared data for those outbursts, especially the middle infrared data with optical near infrared?
Yeah, so during the outburst, usually we do not have coverage in the mid infrared, and if those outbursts were covered in the optical. But you are right that whenever you see a rebrightening that is most likely due to interaction with something, we also have an enhanced infrared flux. Yeah.
Further questions? I have a question. in the 2009 IP, do we gain any insight for how many burps that it had before it really blew up, or conversely, the separation between those, that gap, that time scale, is that telling us anything about what's going on inside?
Yeah, so, and that goes back to the 20 to 40 day time scale. So we have an excess of power there that is statistically significant, yet that time scale doesn't really match any natural time scale of a system that we could think about. But it's definitely something that the system likes, and there must be some very, very good reason why that is happening.
I mean, the star suddenly finds itself about to blow, and it sort of knows it in a way.
Yeah.
And then it calms down for a second, for a period of time. It was, how much was it, a year? It was 2009 IP, and then it was 2012.
3 years, yeah, 3 years later, yeah. Yeah.
So it has a short lifetime after that. Okay. Yeah. Any further questions? Let's thank her again.
Thank you.